Nice to see you. It's just the right time, I think, right? 7:01. So let's begin. Do you have this little prayer to Manjushri?
The homage to Manjushri. Do people have it?
They have.
Or Joey, here's one right here. You can use this one and maybe share with someone. I think we have.
So what we're going to do this in lieu of other prayers. So try to visualize in front of you the aspect of the Buddha's wisdom, Manjushri. Do we have a tanka of Manjushri here? Or a statue? Oh, we need one. We should get a statue of Manjushri, or a tanka. Visualize Manjushri in front. He's very youthful looking, seated, you know, in the Vajra Asana, cross-legged position with his right hand is holding a wisdom sword that cuts through, as it says in the prayer, cuts through the darkness of ignorance. And he holds at his heart the stem of an Utpala flower that blooms next to his left ear, upon which is the Prajnaparamita Sutra, the wisdom, the perfection of wisdom, the wisdom gone beyond, that symbolizes that he knows all of these things, as this prayer actually says. So visualize Manjushri in front, about one body length in front of you, maybe the height of one, you know, your hand outstretched like this from your thumb to your small finger, about one body length in front, radiant light, all the signs of a Buddha, the 32 major marks, 80 minor signs. The same, you know, the Dalai Lama's wisdom, you know, Lama Sopa's wisdom, Geshe-la's wisdom, the wisdom of all your teachers, the wisdom of emptiness manifested in that way. Homage to my guru and protector, Manjushri. You whose intelligence shines forth as the sun, unclouded by delusions or traces of ignorance, who hold to your heart a scriptural text symbolic of seeing all things as they are, who teaches in 60 ways with the loving compassion of a mother for her only son, to all creatures caught in the prison of samsara, confused in the darkness of their ignorance, overwhelmed by their suffering. You whose dragon thunder-like proclamation of Dharma arouses us from the stupor of our delusions and frees us from the iron chains of our karma, who wields the sword of wisdom, hewing down suffering wherever its sprouts appear, clearing away the darkness of all ignorance. You whose princely body is adorned with 112 marks of a Buddha, who has completed the stages, achieving the highest perfections of a Bodhisattva, who has been pure from the beginning. To you, Om Manjushri, I bow down. Om Arapajanadi, Om Arapajanadi, Om Arapajanadi, Om Paranajanadi, Om Paranajanadi, Om Arapajanadi, Om Arapajanadi, Om Arapajanadi. Om Arapajanadi. And take a breath and recite the seed syllable D, if you can, on one breath, 108 times. Om Arapajanadi. And imagine on your tongue the syllable D as you swallow goes down to your heart chakra, and blesses it with the wisdom, this fast wisdom of Manjushri. With the brilliance of your wisdom, O compassionate one, illuminate the darkness enclosing my mind, Enlighten my intelligence and wisdom so that I may gain insight into the Buddha's words and the texts that explain them. Okay, thank you. So, how is everyone? Okay. Hey, Mr. Brown, Dr. Brown. So, Donna, do you remember where we ended last time? Does anyone have an annotated copy of their notes where they put where we got? No. So we talked. Did we talk about the? Oh, okay. So we talked about the five between mind and mental factors, the five similarities. Did we talk about that? Did we skip over that? You know, when I mentioned that there are two main definitions of mind. One is particularly for those who are meditators. I mean, especially adept for someone who's looking at it from an experiential point of view, which is that the mind, the primary mind, is that which knows the mere perceptual field, and the mental factors are those aspects of the mind within it that know individual differentiating features, like feeling or discrimination or wisdom and so forth and so on. Another definition that holds up better in philosophical discussion and in debate is the one that says the primary mind is that mind which bears five similarities with its attendant mental factors. Do you remember that? You must have read that in the text, right? And the mental factors are those that bear five similarities with their primary mind, right? So did we talk about what those five similarities are? I think we might have just touched on that and then we skipped over a little. Do you know what the five similarities are? No? Does anyone know what the five similarities are? Miss Wendy in the back knows. But you're looking at your book, right?
Yes.
Okay, no. I meant from memory, like Manjushri, who knows all things as they are. So it's good to memorize these things. You might think, oh, I can't, there's so many things to memorize. But when you start to memorize some things, you'll find it's very useful for your meditation and for understanding. So here, if my text has the same numbering, enumeration as yours, on page 11 near the bottom it says, the explanation from the treasury of knowledge, that's the Abhidharma Kosha. That's written by Vasubandhu, who was the brother of a Sangha. And here it says the five similarities are similar support, similar object of observation, similar aspect, similar time, or you can also say duration, both work, and similar substance. And so I think maybe we did go there just briefly, because similar support means an eye consciousness, for instance. Or let's use a tongue consciousness. Tongue primary consciousness has within its retinue at least the five omnipresent mental factors, right? And that main mind, main tongue consciousness and its mental factors, they share the same basis or support, the tongue faculty, or as we were saying in the cover, the organ, the tongue organ. Remember? Tongue organ is not this piece of meat. Although generally that's what's called the tongue, right? The tongue organ means a subtle matter within that, probably near the surface, that acts as an interface between the tongue consciousness and its object. So Yeah, if this is the tongue, okay, here's the tongue organ somewhere within the tongue. And when objects of taste, sweet, sour, bitter, astringent, hot, salty, come in contact with that, and a consciousness is also present that can give rise to the tongue consciousness. So that is the support of both the primary consciousness and its mental factors. They have the same or similar support. Here you could also translate, instead of saying similar, you could say same, but then you'd say they bear five samenesses or similarities works also. Similar object of observation means that if you're talking about the eye consciousness, the primary eye consciousness and its mental factors might both be looking at a book I had here. That's right. I remember saying this last time because I remember the blue book. Do you remember that? They might, if the eye consciousness and its mental factors would not be apprehending different objects, like the primary consciousness might be apprehending this, and the mental factors, feeling and so forth, apprehending something else. Not like that. They have the same object of observation, and they both have the same aspect, that is, they would both be understanding the same thing about the book, say the blueness of the book. And say feeling would be experiencing a feeling with regard to the blueness or whatever. They have a similar time. They exist, they're generated, they abide, and they disintegrate at the same time, the primary mind and the mental factors. And they have a similar substance, which in terms of understanding what this means is that generally we say there is just one substance of any primary consciousness. That is to say, you don't have two eye consciousnesses that could be functioning at the same time. You don't have two nose consciousnesses, tactile consciousnesses. You don't have two mental consciousnesses, one of which might be thinking of something and one of which might be thinking of something else. You have just one substance. And likewise, each primary consciousness has just one substance of feeling, one substance of discrimination and so forth of the various mental factors that are in its retinue. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay. So I think we did touch on that last time. And I guess I had jumped then to talking about the mental factors. So that's right. I remember asking if someone remembered divisions, the five omnipresent mental factors, five object ascertaining, and so forth. And someone did pretty well last time. And of these, we had talked a little bit about feeling, right? Feeling is a distinct mental factor within any of the primary consciousnesses, which is the actual experience of the ripening of our past karma in the form of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral feeling. I remember I was trying to tell you some joke that Geshe Zopa always says. When he tries to say he's passed away recently, when he would say neutral, 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 he would try to get neutral out. And he would say, not noodle. Not Chinese noodle, neutral. You know, so there is a kind of feeling which we're experiencing right now. Like, say, if I ask you, what is the feeling in the tip of your left pinky? It's not pleasant, not unpleasant. Maybe it is for you, I don't know. It might be just a neutral feeling if you were to pay attention to it. We're familiar with neutral feeling. So, Feelings are feeling is not something that observes a pleasant, you know, pleasant or unpleasant. It is the very experience of those things. Right? Any questions about feeling? I think we sort of talked a little bit about that last time. There are three, you could say there are three kinds of feelings: pleasant, suffering, and neutral. Also, you can talk about physical feelings and mental feelings. Here it says bodily feelings, lusor, yeah, body feelings. So when it says body feelings, that includes the feelings within the retinue of the five sense consciousnesses. So eye sense consciousness, the feeling within that is called a bodily feeling. Even though it's, you might think bodily feeling just, you might think that it would only refer to tactile, you know, sense of touch, because it uses the word body. But body as opposed to mental consciousness. So the body feelings, or bodily feelings, are called pleasant, suffering, and neutral. And usually, mental pleasant feelings are called, what? Joy or bliss. You know, you have a blissful mind. You know, you have a pleasant feeling within the senses and a blissful feeling within the mind. Mental suffering, mental neutral feelings. I think that's pretty easy. So then if someone asks, what's the reason for calling the feeling that arises in the retinue of an eye consciousness? I'm reading in the bottom of 17. What's the reason for calling that a bodily feeling, even though the eye and the body are not the same? So there's a quotation, very famous quotation from the 400 stanzas, a text by Aryadeva. I bet you have in your library. Do you have a library here? Does anyone have that book? A translation of that book? Don, yeah? What's your name?
Tony.
Tony, Don, do you have? So if you need to borrow this, then. It's a text by Aryadeva. It's translated, Geshe Sonam Rinchen, gave teachings on all of the verses. It's a text by Aryadeva, who is a disciple of Nagarjuna and is considered to be one of the authentic sources for the Majjhimaka philosophy, especially one particular thing for understanding changeable suffering. Do you know what changeable suffering is? Changeable suffering? No. Yeah. Suffering of, well, it depends on how you understand suffering of change. If you say suffering of change, or it just depends on how you understand the words, it almost sounds like it's suffering that comes about because of things changing. What do you think, Wendy? Miss Wendy?
I was wondering, what is the name of the text you're talking about?
The 400 stanzas on the yogic activities of bodhisattvas is a long title. But usually in Tibetan, they just call it the 400. And everyone knows what they're talking about. There were 400 verses. I think she just wanted to know the yogic activities of bodhisattvas. I think that's the title. That's how it's translated in the title of that translation. So when you talk about suffering, you know there are three kinds of suffering. Now you know. What is it? Suffering of suffering. Changeable suffering or suffering of change. All-pervasive, compounding suffering. More and more subtle as you get along. So, changeable suffering is an example of changeable suffering are all the contaminated, pleasant feelings that we have now, whether it be happy feelings in the mental consciousness or in the physical senses. All the pleasant feelings that you experience that are contaminated feelings, they're all changeable suffering. Anyway, say, excuse me, no, they're not suffering, they are
It's good, the pleasure, you know. But from the very, it's not that you have to wait for them to change, that they'll eventually change into suffering. From the, in the 400 stanzas in an earlier, I think the second chapter, there's a large explanation that's sort of the source for understanding this very well about changeable suffering. From the very moment of experiencing them, they are dukkha. You know that word? Suffering. Or, you know, some people like to say unsatisfactory. Unsatisfactoriness. From the very moment you have some suffering of heat, and then you come out in the cool breeze or the air-conditioned room, the suffering of heat goes down, the suffering of cool goes up. I explained this before. You've heard in other contexts. We experience that changing of one suffering for another as pleasure, as relief. Maybe it's a nice way of saying relief. Like when you have a toothache and you take a pain reliever. The suffering goes down, but the suffering of the pain reliever, if you kept on taking that, you'd die, right? You kept on taking more and more, whatever. So in that same text, there are many quotations from the 400 stanzas by Aryadeva. This one says, just as the body sense power, the faculty of the body, pervades the body, likewise ignorance abides in all. So it's not completely relevant to this situation. I think the author wanted to get this in somehow, this quotation. So the body sense power pervades the whole body. Even your, if you stick a needle in your eye or in your tongue faculty, you will also feel pain. Physical pain, right? Not just feeling in the eye consciousness. If you stick a needle in the eye, if you get dust or a little insect in your eye, it hurts, right? I think we talked about this also, that the feeling, the body sense faculty may not pervade to the brain itself, because people who do brain operations, the person doesn't necessarily feel any pain when the brain is cut. It doesn't pervade the hair. I don't have any hair. If you pull a hair, of course, you pull on the roots, then you're talking about inside. Likewise, just as the body sense power or faculty pervades the entire body, all of the organs, likewise ignorance of true existence pervades all of our mental activities. So that will come in more detail later. Okay. Yes, Mr. Brown. Yeah.
Yep. I'd like to change. Hello.
Hello. It's on. We heard you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, changeable suffering. You know, it's, I mean, I get that, you know, there's an increase, for example, if you go out from a hot place into a cold place, I get that there's this increase in the suffering of coldness, that eventually, coolness, which eventually becomes a problem, as the suffering of being in the heat begins to diminish. And on that process, we have a pleasant feeling, particularly if we've been too hot, on that whole, as that thing is happening, there's a pleasant feeling.
That's, our mind labels that as pleasant. That's what we experience.
We label that as pleasant. So it's real, and it's pleasant.
It's real, and what degree? You mean true? It truly existed real? No, not that.
No, but it's real for the person who's experiencing it.
Yeah,
it's
not. Yeah, you know, I can't say,
if I'm having a pleasant feeling from eating a good meal to you name it, that for me, in the moment I'm experiencing it, in spite of the fact that it's this, I'm labeling it pleasant and it's making my mind happy.
Right.
I know it won't last,
right.
But it's real.
Yeah, yeah.
Now,
yeah.
So it's almost like,
yeah, this is
almost like you're saying, it's not really pleasant. But it is.
No, it is. No, I didn't say that. I didn't say it's not really present. I said it's changeable suffering. So from the very moment that we're experiencing it, it is of the nature of suffering. It's not suffering, but it's the nature of suffering. You could say it's suffering because it's changeable suffering, but we label, our mind labels changeable suffering as pleasant. Changeable pleasant. It's just relief, really. Exchanging one contaminated suffering for another. And when the larger suffering is still going down, when it's still in that position, that's relief, right? Ah, but then when the one that's ascending gets a little bit higher, let's sit in the nice warm sun again, you know, we think then the situation changes. So that it is, you have to say that it's what we call pleasure. In fact, is enumerated here as pleasant feeling, but pleasant contaminated feelings, which are most of the feelings, all of the feelings that we experience,
contaminated
by ego grasping,
yeah,
grasping to an ego, and having been thrown by, karma. Having what created that karma, the contaminated feeling, was contaminated actions. Actions that were contaminated, like the body sense pervades the body, ignorance pervades all of our activities. So all of our activities, even virtuous ones, are contaminated virtue. They're contaminated by the belief in a creator, an action, a recipient of the action, or, an object acted upon and so forth, that are truly existent or inherently existent. And therefore, those actions are said to be contaminated because they give rise to, the most they can give rise to when they ripen like this in samsara is contaminated feeling of pleasure, if it's virtue that we've created, contaminated virtue. And the most that can be is just relief. So we can find some relief, but if we think that somehow within cyclic existence, the champagne or the yacht or the beautiful boys or girls, that would be real pleasure, In Singapore, they talk about, over the years I visited Singapore, they expanded, it used to be three C's, country club, condominium, and car, and then later it was credit card, or other things, cell phone, four C's, five C's, real pleasure, condominium, your bank account, and all of this sort of stuff. We know most of the people who are attracted to the spiritual path, especially Buddhism, have a little inkling of that these things are not really satisfying. That, you get a certain amount of relief for a certain while, but it doesn't last. That's one sense of the changeable. Even the relief doesn't last. But Arya Deva's particular emphasis in the 400 stanzas in that, I think, the second chapter, which the Dalai Lama points out is sort of like a source for that understanding of changeable suffering. Even from the very moment of experiencing it, it's not real pleasure. Well, you wanted to say it is real pleasure. It's not true pleasure. It's just relief. It's exchanging one suffering with another. If you start to think about that, that's something that the human mind can understand. Generally, animals, dogs, cats can't understand that. They can understand suffering of suffering, but they don't understand that changeable suffering is something that could be shunned, that pleasant feelings are something that you could develop a renunciation for. Right? Ordinary beings like ourselves don't understand the third kind of suffering so clearly. We can understand through logic, we can understand changeable suffering, that just the bliss of sexual embrace or the bliss of the taste of food is something that we could give up because, it doesn't last. It's not real happiness. It's not going to bring, it's not something that is a path, pursuing that is a path that can bring you you know, deliverance. It was a word you were talking about the other day, you know, deliverance for suffering. If I had enough stracciatella ice cream, or, you know, enough beer, or my stash of, you know, whatever it is, your magazines or your videotapes or your drug supply or whatever is your, what's the thing that people, that Rush Limbaugh takes, oxycodone or whatever, you know, that you would be, if you had that stash, that you'd always be happy. It's just relief. It's not real happiness. Now, you wanted to say it's real happiness, so it's something to think about. Okay? What? So I don't want to pursue... Yeah, go on.
You don't want to what?
No, I was going to say I don't want to pursue too much further, but if you have some follow-up, like in the press conference, you get one follow-up. Yeah, make it good.
Make it count. Okay, so I think Buddhism gets a bad rap because it says there's no such thing as pleasure, or, you know, that... What's pleasurable is not pleasurable.
It's pleasure, but it's not real pleasure the way that our mind thinks that it's something. Pleasure has the connotation in our mind, like real pleasure. If you had the object that induces that, you'd always be happy.
Yeah.
But that's not the case. We posit
permanence and purity and all that stuff on things that we're attached to. I got that part. But, I mean, I'm just saying, let me just say it another way and see if this sounds right.
Yeah.
So, you know, ordinary pleasures that we human beings experience, you know, when we experience them, for the individual experiencing the pleasure, it is a pleasant feeling and it is pleasure.
Definitely.
But
its relief.
Nature is suffering.
Yeah, that's right.
True nature is suffering. But we label that
true nature is empty. It's true nature is
true
empty.
Nature
being
is
empty, empty. It's nature.
But
it's conventional nature. It's conventional nature is actually the nature of suffering.
Yes.
Even though we experience it, it's like say you see a drug addict, and they're in the booze or whatever you call it. You know, they need some fix, and then they get this dirty needle, you know, someone gives them a dirty hypo with some heroin or something in it, and you're thinking, oh, don't take that, that's not real happiness. That's not the source of happiness. They take that, and there's some incredible relief for them at that moment. We look at them and most of us, unless we're really depressed or, you know, we have strong imprint interest in that, most of us look at them and say, that's not real. What you're experiencing is not real pleasure. It's not sustainable. It's just, you know, it's just, you're just getting your fix right now. When you, later, when one gets above the other, you're going to, what do you get? The shakes, or I don't know, you go into withdrawal or something like that if you don't get it again. It's not real pleasure. Even now, we don't envy you what you're experiencing. It's just, do you see what I'm... So the person who understands changeable suffering sees our interest, even our own personal interest in pleasures, you know, pleasure of food and beautiful sights, beautiful music and fragrances and, you know, pleasure of the sense consciousness, of the physical sense consciousness, especially sexual pleasure, sees all of those as unsatisfactory. There's a verse in the Yonden Chögyurma, the foundation of all good qualities. Chepe mingom dugnel kungigo iten birum sipe punzoki nemik ritne tarpe dewala danir jimbo gonar jimbo jingilop. It means please grant me blessings to see the shortcomings of samsaric perfections. Islam Yeshi like to translate this as Sipe Punsok. Someone told me once they'd never heard of samsaric perfections before. You know, we talk about the six perfections. Punsok actually means the pinnacle. The pinnacles or the best of samsara. You know, beautiful forms and shapes and smells and tastes and embrace and praise and wealth and power. Oh, man! Please grant me blessings to see the shortcomings of samsaric perfections. One, and all of the shortcomings summarized into three. Chepe mingom means by experiencing them, utilizing them, there's no real satisfaction. You know, I say, well, I'm satisfied. I get my pizza and I'm, you know, I get my chocolate. Or I'm satisfied. But it doesn't, you know, later you're going to want chocolate again. You're going to want pizza again. You're going to want embrace again. You want to, hearing praise once is not enough. Even though we might think, okay, I'm not going to work anymore to hear praise, but later you want, you're not satiated with that. So the first one, there's no satisfaction in experiencing samsaric perfections. Chepe Mingon, Dugnal Kungigo, they are the door of all suffering. So pursuing samsaric perfections, when you know, looking after them, like the drug addict, we get into creating negative karma, and then we get into situations that we never really wanted. We have a baby, you know, something like this. We didn't expect, you know. Or you take that prestigious job and then suddenly you've got all sorts of, you know, work that you have to do, and you have to go to chicken dinners and all this sort of stuff. And that's trivial examples. But the doorway, we spend our life then we have no time to do retreat, pursuing samsaric perfections. I can't take time off from work, George, to do a retreat. I've got a job. You know, what do you expect? Who can do that? Only you guys, you know, or something like that. You know, pursuing samsaric perfections, a doorway to all suffering. And third, Yiten, they're unreliable. You know, simply encountering the chocolate doesn't always bring pleasure. It's uncertain. It depends on the situation. You know. Okay, let me just continue on, because we've after today there are only three more sessions to fill all, to finish all the 51 mental factors. Okay, so we'll talk in the question and answer another time. So here there's a question about what do materialistic and non-materialistic feelings, what's the difference between those? So I don't know if you know, I'm sure you probably don't know Tibetan. Zangzing is a Tibetan word that is translated here as materialistic. The Sanskrit is amisha. Amisha sort of can mean earthy, fleshy, external goods as opposed to internal dharmas, internal phenomena. So there's materialistic, these sort of, pleasures of the flesh, we say, right? And non-materialist mean response. The answer is feelings that are concomitant with the craving for contaminated, appropriated aggregates are called materialistic feelings. Do you know what the contaminated, appropriate aggregates are? Do you know? Have you ever heard that expression? This gentleman?
Yeah.
Yeah. So can you give a short peanut size explanation? What are the contaminated, appropriated aggregates?
I've heard of them, but I don't know.
Oh, okay. You've heard of them. Okay. That's good. That's a good answer. Don, you know?
Just body?
Well, what does that mean? Contaminated, appropriated aggregates. Aggregates we know, right? The five aggregates or five skandhas? Okay. What is the word contaminated, the words contaminated and appropriated mean?
Contaminated because we're still in samsara, so we're still under the process of uncontrolled causation. We're not free.
Our aggregates, including our mind, all of the things within our continuum are contaminated by ego grasping.
And I think, I'm not sure what appropriated is.
Appropriated has to do with the fact that we've gotten these aggregates right now, this sack of pus and blood, because of a mind in the bardo state, seeing, say, our mother and father and having some desire to enter into that fertilized egg. So we appropriate these aggregates out of ignorance and due to karma and ignorance. That's how we end up in this. So they're called appropriated, and they're also called appropriating, you can say, because of these contaminated aggregates, they appropriate, they grab. You know what appropriate means? Take for yourself, right? We're appropriating your rice crop, the Chinese troops might say. We're taking them over for ourselves. We're taking, taking over. So they're called appropriating also. The same word could be thought that way because these aggregates appropriate the next life because of this contaminations within our mind. Okay. Let's see. Let's go on.
So,
yeah.
So in terms of materialistic and non-materialistic, so all the feelings that are, like it says, concomitant with the cravings for contaminated appropriate aggregates, those are considered materialistic.
Right, fleshy feelings, whatever. Yeah.
Okay.
Feelings that are not concomitant with the feelings that are concomitant or bear similarities with the exalted wisdom directly realizing selflessness are called non-fleshy or non-materialistic. So probably we don't have any of those because if you have a wisdom directly realizing selflessness, you wouldn't be here listening to me. Or maybe you would. Maybe you're a great bodhisattva out of compassion. Concomitant? Is that concomitant? Is that sort of British pronunciation? Don't we say concomitant? Concomitant means coming together with. So, yeah. So the way that we have translated it earlier, or in other contexts, is we say that bear similarities with. The craving that bears similarities with the appropriated aggregates are called materialistic feelings. The feelings that bear similarities with the exalted wisdom directly realizing selflessness. So in your mental consciousness, if you're realizing emptiness directly, you have a wisdom within that consciousness, a mental factor, that's realizing emptiness directly. Within that another mental factor within that main mind that's realizing emptiness is feeling, because it's an omnipresent mental factor, and that feeling would be called a non-materialistic or non-fleshy feeling because it's bearing similarities with that wisdom directly realizing emptiness. So, okay. So let's talk about the next one, discrimination. This is very important. Discrimination, Tibetan Duche. Regarding the entity or the definition of discrimination, Abhidharma Kosha says, what's the defining characteristics of discrimination? In answer to that, it says, it has the characteristic of knowing upon aggregation. It has the entity of apprehending the sign and apprehending the mark through which one designates an expression to objects of perception, hearing, differentiation, and knowledge. We also talked a little bit about this last time, no? So, what is discrimination? When it talks about knowing upon aggregation, I mentioned what that's referring to, and it says, just in the next paragraph, it says, just as has been said above, it is a knower that upon aggregation of the three, object, sense power, and primary consciousness, when those three come together, say this eye sense, a visual form, and the eye consciousness, when they all meet, upon aggregation or joining of those, it apprehends the uncommon sign of an object. So once there is contact, the mental factor that's going to be talked about a little bit later, that empowers the sense power to act as that interface between the consciousness and its object. That's what the contact does. As a result of that, discrimination can rise, knowing particular marks about the field, about the object. In the sense consciousness, it's not a thinking discrimination. Like we say, he or she is a discriminating person. You ever hear that kind of terminology? Oh, that's very discriminating of you to see one thing as better than the other, Do you know what I'm talking about? That's in the mental consciousness. That's one kind of discrimination. But in the sense consciousnesses, eye, ear, nose, taste, tongue, and tactile. Discrimination is just the ability of that consciousness to recognize the various details of the perceptual field. Otherwise, without discrimination, let's say in the eye consciousness, what I'm seeing right now with all these colored prayer flags and banners and individual people, I would just see one sort of uniform mass of color. Discrimination is the, in the sense consciousness, it just allows the is a factor that allows the consciousness to see the individual differentiating features. Okay? Make sense? Why not? We should have a couple of microphones hanging around somewhere at different places.
Isn't that discriminating? If that discriminating consciousness does not distinguish objects because it doesn't hold self-existence, it just sees a mass of color, what you're basically saying is that an enlightened being cannot chew bubblegum and walk straight at the same time.
No, I don't see the connection at all. No, I'm saying discrimination is always present in a regular consciousness. Certainly in the Buddhist consciousness also, it's an omnipresent mental factor. That means always present within any primary consciousness. So any primary consciousness does see the differentiating features or hears the differentiating features of the sounds and smells and tastes and so forth. So the Buddha can walk and chew gum at the same time.
Thank you.
Otherwise, it's a big, how to say, finding, you know, criticizing the Buddha, you know, not recognizing all his qualities. The Buddha can walk and chew gum at the same time, and a lot of other things too. Okay. The basis of engagement for these two types of discrimination. Because we just talked right before that on page, at the top of page 20, it says, the apprehension of a sign in it is an apprehension of an uncommon sign of an object which appears to a non-conceptual consciousness. The apprehension of a mark is the apprehension of an uncommon sign of an object which appears to conceptual thought. So do you remember what the difference is between conceptual and non-conceptual consciousness? Eye consciousness is conceptual or non-conceptual? Non-conceptual. It doesn't conceive, it doesn't think, wow, that's beautiful, that's done by the mental consciousness. Conceptual consciousness. Our mental consciousness is totally conceptual, as opposed to the senses, which are non-conceptual. You're thinking right, yeah? Okay, so there's no non-conceptual experience consciousness within the mental consciousness.
No, you couldn't realize emptiness.
Well, you can realize emptiness conceptually.
Conceptually, but you couldn't realize emptiness directly.
Non-conceptually or directly, yeah. So mental consciousness does know some things non-conceptually, but in our ordinary experience as human beings, the instances of that non-conceptual realization of our mental consciousness are very rare. It's said that some dream states, certain lucid dreams, may be direct non-conceptual consciousness. You might say, wow, what is it knowing? But anyway, it's a little bit complicated to understand. Mental consciousness may have a thought instant of direct apprehension of what our eye sees at the beginning of a series of looking at something or what our ear hears. But in general, everything that takes place in our mind now is conceptual. We're thinking about things by means of, you know, different kinds of conceptual thought, mental images. Visual imagery is conceptual. Thinking process, talking to yourself, memories, all of these are conceptual. Okay? So it says the bases of engagement of these two types of discrimination are perceptions, hearing, differentiation, and knowledge. Okay, I'm not going to go into that. You can read about that. Do we have to be discriminating here too? Okay. Yes. Yes, sir. Remind me of your name. Paul.
Well, it seems...
Yeah, you just have to point it like an ice cream cone. There you go.
Got it now?
Yep. Yeah.
Well, it seems that in life things sometimes happen where you don't... And sometimes things happen, say, quickly, like you're falling, you know, and you find some way, you end up right, but you really can't say, how did I do that?
Hmm.
If you could, you probably wouldn't have, right? That sort of thing. I mean, everybody runs into that sooner or later.
Right.
And so was that conceptual thought or not that was going on when you can't even explain what it was?
Well, that's I think, you know, you would, say for instance, if you started experiencing a fall and you reach out to grab something, you are experiencing with your sense consciousness, like an accelerometer in your phone or something like that, you know.
Why would my sense consciousness care?
Is that a matter of caring there? First of all, it experiences that, right? And if you were completely inebriated, you might just completely fall over. You have to have some certain amount of desire for self-preservation within your mind, you know, some kind of mental consciousness present. And I think that is, then that triggers some response to the muscles. You know, and there may be some things that are that the response of your muscles are. Are you with me, the response of your muscles may be, addressed by the brainstem. Something in a much more elementary thing, like what is it called, the autonomic nervous system. It's just like your breathing. You don't have to think about breathing. You might say, "Why do I breathe? I'm not thinking. I want to breathe." It's something that just continues to take place. It's not conceptual, but it's done by the sense consciousnesses themselves. I think, you know, some firing, some information given to the solar plexus to rise and fall and so forth. Okay, maybe not satisfying enough, but let's continue on. Next one, third one, intention, Tibetan Sempa. So what is intention? It is a compositional mental action of the mind. It has the function of engaging the mind in virtue, non-virtue, or the unspecified, or you could say neutral, unspecified, unpredicted. So this is very important. This is one of the most important mental factors because it's the mental factor that moves the mind, whether it be the sense consciousnesses moving to the general perceptual field or the mental consciousness moving. It could be likened to a hand with, let's say, if I had a cloth, if this was a nice wooden tabletop, and I had a cloth underneath my hand, the movement of the hand would be like intention. What's underneath the cloth, whether it be polish or grit, if I move it with the cloth, if I move grit, it's almost like sandpaper then, right? What would I do to the surface of the table? I'll leave some scratches in it. If I had polish underneath, it's like I'm likening that to like a virtuous mental factor present in the mind. I would kind of polish the surface. So intention itself is a movement of the mind. It creates karma, but it itself, the intention is not virtuous or non-virtuous. The intention creates virtuous non-virtuous or unpredicted karma, which means neutral karma, depending on what other mental factors are in the mind. You know, other, whether they're virtuous or non-virtuous or neutral mental feelings in the mind, mental factors in the mind. Yes, Wendy.
Thupten Tende said one time that he had to buy some new shoes.
Thupten Tende said at one time he had to buy some new shoes. Okay.
Thupten Tende said at one time he had to buy some new shoes when he was in England.
Yeah.
And he couldn't find the good, he didn't know where the shoe stores were, but everywhere he went, that he noticed other people's shoes and what they were wearing and wondered where they got them and would ask them where to go. So his intention was controlling, guiding what he saw. So for that period of time, he said, he found it very strange that he noticed shoes more than he ever did most of the time. Now, is that intention or is that some other mental factor?
You said his intention did this. Yeah. So intention is a mental factor that moves the mind. In this case, the mental thinking about this. So I want to find shoes. Then you would be paying attention. The mental consciousness would be paying attention to the eye consciousness, and the eye consciousness itself would, in response to that, maybe be looking at shoes. Okay? That would be an intention in the mental, in the eye consciousness also, as a result of your thinking in the mental consciousness. So what I want to say about this is that that intention, it itself is not virtuous or non-virtuous. It becomes, it creates, by its movement of the mind, it's like pulling, like this, pulling this cloth that has underneath it either grit or polish or, you know, some other example like that. By its movement of something which is already in the mind, it creates, thereby creates virtue. If you have a virtuous mental factor in the mind and the mind is, you know, you're applying yourself to some activity, you're thinking about that, you are creating virtuous karma as a result of that intention. That mental factor that moves the mind is intention. Okay, to the general perceptual field. Here it says, on just near the top of page 22, just as is said above, the mental factor which rouses and moves the mind that is concomitant with it to an object is called intention. So it moves the primary consciousness to a particular object. This is said to be the principle among all mental factors, the main one. Why is that? It is taught that any mind or mental factor engages an object due to the power of this mental factor. Even the other, you know, wisdom, if you're thinking about emptiness, you're doing a meditation on emptiness or the four-point analysis or something, the reason that your wisdom engages various thoughts and analyzing various things, moves from one to the other, is due to this mental factor, intention. So if your intention is to benefit sentient beings, you know, you will be thinking about them in various ways like this. If your aspiration, rather, is to benefit sentient beings, intention moving that aspiration, thinking about sentient beings' plight, wishing them to be free of that, that intention that moves the mind from one thing to the other, when present in the mind is the aspiration to benefit them, that's creating virtuous karma. Okay? Yes, sir. Yeah, you can say. Say, I'll repeat until the microphone gets to you, and then you don't have to repeat it again.
Intention and motivation, those words often get used interchangeably, but I don't think they're really the same thing.
Intention and motivation, not necessarily the same thing. If we talk about it in a very a gross sense, we could say that I had the intention to bring to benefit sentient beings. Then you could talk about motivation. Motivation includes various other factors. Motivation generally precedes an action, right? It's the it may be the precipitating cause for an action, you know, wanting to get a drink of water, so looking around and finding, you know, a source of water or Coke or whatever like that. When we do meditation, we want to try to have in our mind to begin with a motivation which is virtuous, because the precipitating motivation before the action is done, like say you're going to do prostrations, you want to try to have a virtuous motivation beforehand, because even if you forget about your motivation during the, maybe if you do 100 prostrations, 50 prostrations, even if you forget about your motivation during the time, what set this action into motion, the precipitating motivation, gives the general tenor, gives this general flavor or the general nature of that action being virtuous or non-virtuous, even if your mind wanders. Of course, if during that time you have thoughts when you're getting angry, or, you know, why are these people preventing me from prostrating, or, you know, that's stupid, or blah, 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 you can overcome that initial motivation. There are two kinds of motivation: motivation that precedes the action and the motivation that takes place during the action. Of the two, the motivation beforehand is more important.
And just to follow up on that, Jeffrey Hopkins, I've heard his...
You only get a certain number of follow-ups, you know.
No, this is the second one.
Yeah.
He talks about bodhicitta as the... This, I've heard him say this, and correct me if I'm wrong. It's the altruistic intention to become enlightened, motivated by love and compassion.
Mm-hmm.
Would you have a problem with that?
You sound like you're from New York. You got a problem with that? And my cousin is an archetypal New Yorker. You got a problem with that? So altruistic.
Intention.
So here, the word intention is being used in maybe just to make it sound nice. We would say you're talking about bodhicitta, right? Conventional mind of bodhicitta is a special Mahayana primary mind. We'll talk about this later. It's a primary mind, primary mental consciousness that acts as a doorway of the Mahayana, that is preceded by the aspiration to alleviate, is preceded by compassion for sentient beings. It's an aspiration to alleviate the suffering of sentient beings. So it's one aspiration, that's it. And is simultaneous with the aspiration to attain enlightenment. So there's two aspirations. We're going to talk about aspiration and hopefully in a couple of minutes, maybe not. Aspiration is one of the object ascertaining mental factors. Aspiration is like the same thing, wishing. So it's the wish. You could say it's the intention. But bodhicitta is a primary mind that has that aspiration to achieve enlightenment, and it has been preceded, maybe the previous moment or a long time before, motivated by the aspiration to bring about the end of suffering of sentient beings. If you say compassion, but it's an aspiration, the two aspirations. Bodhicitta itself is not a mental factor. It does have mental factors within its retinue. And the primary mental factor in bodhicitta at the time bodhicitta is present is the aspiration to achieve enlightenment. You might say, but wait, that sounds greedy. You know, it should be the aspiration to alleviate the suffering of sentient beings. That aspiration has to precede any moment of bodhicitta. It's always motivated by the aspiration to alleviate the suffering of sentient beings. and is always concomitant, is simultaneous with an aspiration in its retinue to achieve, I must achieve enlightenment, because it knows, you know, suffering of sentient beings is unbearable. I must alleviate that. How can I do that? The best and only way that I could do that for all sentient beings is I must achieve enlightenment. I must become a Buddha. So that's the motivating aspiration. So when it says the intention, it's just perhaps you don't remember it correctly, or maybe if he did say that, it's just another way of saying aspiration in this case. Okay. So, no. Otherwise, we'll never, you know, in these six classes, we will never get beyond the object, we'll never get beyond the omnipresent mental factor, which could be useful, but let's wait, wait afterwards. Okay. So, furthermore, when actions are divided, I'm on the top of page 23. When actions are divided, there are three: virtuous, non-virtuous, unspecified. So that's a terminology that the Buddha used. Sometimes we used to translate that as unpredicted. Lungmaten. Lung in Tibetan means pronouncement or prediction. Like the Lungten means the Buddha gave a prediction. You know, Paul in the future life will become the Buddha, radiant light in the Pure Land, this and that. You know, making a prediction. Or that action that you just did will bring about your achievement of enlightenment or this or that. Those are predictions that the Buddha made, right? So there's certain kinds of actions that the Buddha would say, this will bring about happiness in the future. Those are called virtuous actions. Those actions that the Buddha said, these things are to be avoided, they will bring about suffering. Other actions the Buddha didn't specify as being bringing about happiness or suffering are called unpredicted or unspecified. Essentially, they're neutral actions. Buddha did talk about neutral actions, but he didn't point them out. He usually was pointing out things that were virtuous or non-virtuous, right? So that's kind of the origin of that phrase. Why don't they just say neutral? Unspecified or unpredicted just comes about because of the history of Buddhism. There's also another way of dividing up the pizza pie of actions. And you know the word action means is, what is it in Sanskrit? Do you know the Sanskrit word for action? Karma. Right? So you can divide up the pizza pie of karma another way: meritorious, non-meritorious, and immovable. So does that cut up the whole pizza pie? Maybe not. But that's another way of dividing merit. There'll be some slice left off of neutral karma. Meritorious actions are those that will bring about pleasure in the future, in the desire realm. Non-meritorious, or in any of the realms, pleasure. Non-meritorious actions are actions that bring about suffering, so you could say they're non-virtuous. Immovable actions. What are immovable actions? Does anyone know? You must have heard before. They don't do anything? No, they. What the sense of movability here is that they can only ripen in a particular way. Like, say, for instance, if you achieve the preparation to the first concentration. Remember we were talking about before, or maybe it was in the Vajracchedika talks. There, besides this desire realm that we experience, there are mental states that you can achieve through concentration. When you develop fully qualified tranquil abiding, or shine, you've heard that term? Shine? Or shamatha? Actual, fully qualified concentration. When you have that mind, that's called a preparation for the first concentration. By learning within that concentrated mind to analyze, it's called vipassana. You know, it's kind of wisdom consciousness. You analyze the defects of the desire realm and the qualities of the first concentration, which is a realm you can be born into, but it's also a mental state that you can access. by analyzing in that way and developing vipassana, you can actually achieve the first dhyana. Did we talk about that in this class? Or that was in the Vajracchedika seminar? Some of you may have been in both. Yeah. You can access a mental state of the first dhyana. In Pali, that the word dhyana is pronounced jhana. You ever hear of jhanas? The trances or something like that. They're actually, it's what the, in the time of the Buddha, the monastics would try to develop these as a way to overcome their attachment until they've realized selflessness. This is a temporary panacea to have the, in Pali you say the jhanas, but in Sanskrit the word is dhyana. So immovable karma is, let's say if you, in this lifetime, if you developed tranquil abiding and you pursued that to have the, to prepare to enter into the first dhyana, the first form realm concentration, you would create a particular kind of karma that could only give rebirth in some lifetime after this as a form realm god in the Brahma realm. It's also called the Brahma realm. Have you ever heard of that? The Brahma realm? You know, like the god Brahma that came to Buddha along with Indra to request the Buddha to turn the wheel of Dharma. Indra is the king of the desire realm gods on the top of Mount Meru. Indra. Brahma is the being who is the supreme being in the fourth concentration, the form realm concentration, is in the form realm. Still has a form, but much more subtle mind and everything. So immovable karma is our actions that can only give their maturation in a particular realm. Okay?
Is that a bad thing?
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure if that's a bad thing or a good thing. That's it's just, if you, you know, certain, the arhats, say the shravakas, the pratika buddhas, and some of the bodhisattvas actually generate these concentrations and thereby create immovable karma to be born in the form realm or even in the formless realm. When we talked about the four kinds of Arya beings, again, it wasn't in this class, we talked about it in the Vajracchedika Sutra class, the seminar. Remember what the four Aryas were? Were you there?
Okay.
They're brain dead tonight. So there was something called, you know what an Arya is, right? An Arya being? Arya beings are beings that have realized, they're called superiors or Aryas because they've realized emptiness directly, so they're superior to so-called ordinary beings who have not yet realized emptiness directly. That's the sense of Arya. So there are various, the Buddha gave four divisions of Arya. There are many, many divisions. You can divide into 20 and millions, but he called stream enterers, once returners,
never
non-returners, never returners, arhats. So arhats are, you know, when you achieve the goal, it's like no more learning, you're right, but they're called arhats, so they're four divisions. So the beings who are not yet arhats, the Aryas, may actually create the karma to be born. A non-returner is someone who will achieve nirvana without being reborn again in the desire realm. Let's say as a human or an animal or something like that. They'll achieve enlightenment in the nirvana in the form or formless realm. Be patient. Otherwise, we've got 5 minutes left. Okay, next mental factor. What have we talked about? Three so far. Feeling, discrimination, intention, which is the principle of karma. Now contact, Tibetan rekpa. What is contact? It distinguishes its object, this sort of has to be understood from the context here, and transforms the sense power upon the aggregation of the three. So this is very sort of a super condensed definition. It has the function of acting as a support for feeling. So what does this mean? I smell something burning. Is there a candle?
There's a candle behind you.
Oh, maybe it just went out. Okay, no problem. Okay. Sometimes it's auspicious if the gompa burns down. The lama says, don't worry, that shows, you know, you've purified all the negative. I don't want that to happen while I'm here. Well, even though it might be auspicious. So when a consciousness, let's say an eye consciousness, is present in juxtaposition in the eye organ, and a suitable object of sight is present, like say the reflection on the retina and the subtle organ, eye organ, of shape and color. You can imagine that, right? And the consciousness is there, the organ is there, but the organ as yet has not the power to act as the interface that can give rise to the eye consciousness of the shape and color that's present. Contact is the mental factor that is said to transform the sense power into an entity that is capable of perceiving its object. It's not something that brings the consciousness in contact with the object. It is just the mental factor, the presence. When the three are in contact, it empowers the consciousness. It empowers the sense base, the power. What are we calling? Not the sense consciousness, the sense faculty or organ.
Yes, sense power is what it's referred to in...
Power. It is sort of the Indian word is indriya, which means can mean, like when we talk about Indra, the powerful one. Indriya means power, or sometimes it's called faculty, the sense faculty, eye faculty, or the eye sense power. What's another word we use? The eye organ. Okay, eye organ doesn't mean the physical eye. It means that subtle faculty or indriya that's within the eye that acts as the interface. So let me read to you from another text. This is one teachings by Geshe Rapton, and where he talked about the definition, the way he gave it. Contact is a distinct mental factor that, by connecting the object, organ, and primary consciousness, activates the organ. It is said to activate the organ since, due to its cooperation, the organ is transformed into an entity with the ability to act as the basis for feelings of pleasure, pain, or indifference. So contact is there, and it precedes the experience of feeling of pleasure, pain, or indifference. It's a cause of that. So these are things you can read more in detail, and I'll ask you can discuss later also. The fifth of the omnipresent mental factors is called attention, yila chepa, as opposed to intention. Even the words sound the same, right? That's just English. The Tibetan words or the Indian words are completely different sounding. But intention moves the mind to the primary consciousness and its mental factors to a general object. Attention is what moves the mind to a particular object of observation. What is attention? This is on the bottom of page 24. It is an engagement of the mind. It has the function of holding the mind to the object of observation. It is a knower, that is to say, attention is a knower, a mind, that focuses the mind, which is concomitant with it, on a particular object of observation. Not just the general, an intention moves the mind to a general object. Attention sort of focuses in on it. What is the difference between intention and attention? This is just between page 24 and 25, just where 25 begins. What is the difference between intention and attention? Intention moves the mind to general objects, whereas attention directs the mind to particular objects. Okay? Then there's a little discussion here of the category of omnipresent mental factors. What's the reason for calling the five mental factors feeling and so forth? What are the five? Feeling, discrimination, intention,
contact,
attention. Okay, and that's in this order. You could put them in other orders. What's the reason for calling them omnipresent? Or Tibetan kundro, kundro nga, all going, going all the time. They are so called because they are mental factors that accompany all minds. Furthermore, if any of the five omnipresent factors are missing, then the utilization or enjoyment of an object or use of an object will not be complete. There's sometimes, you know, when you're about to fall asleep, your eye consciousness may not have all the mental factors fully manifest. In general, they're always present, though, in an awake, regular mental consciousness, a regular consciousness. At the time of death, at the time of birth, falling asleep, fading, certain situations like that, all of them may not be present. Then, I'm just going to introduce a little the five object-ascertaining mental factors. Aspiration, that's what we were talking about, the aspiration for enlightenment, the aspiration to alleviate the suffering of sentient beings. It's desire. Is desire bad? Does Buddhism say desire is bad?
No.
You might think that it's the root of, in the Theravada sometimes they say desire is the root of samsara. What do you think? What do you think? Yeah. What's your name? I forgot.
My name's Mark.
Mark.
The root is ignorance.
The root of samsara is ignorance, but what is aspiration, if I were to translate aspiration as desire, isn't that a bad thing? Don't Buddhists want to get rid of desires?
No, because there's the desire to attain enlightenment.
There you go.
Positive desires.
There you go.
For bodhisattvas, there's a desire to remain in samsara to benefit sentient beings.
Right. There are many kinds of desires that are positive. When a desire, say for chocolate, arises and your mind exaggerates the quality of chocolate or the quality of the person that you have a desire to have a relationship with, or exaggerates the qualities of, quote, relationship, or the pleasure, you know, thinking all the pleasures that could be there, I would be really happy, blah, blah, blah. Then that desire could become attachment. It could transform into attachment. Attachment is a klesha, a negative mental factor, right? Non-virtuous mental factor that is a kind of desire, but it is a separate mental factor completely than aspiration. But it might have started out from an aspiration for something and then the mind thinking about the wrong way. If I had that, boy, look at that beautiful shape, the beautiful, you know, soft skin, his hair, or in the case of a man, rough skin, I don't know, what are women like, the stubble, whatever, you know, the mind attending inappropriately to the object, then that aspiration can give rise to attachment, which wants to get that, sort of as though it's sunk into the object. But the aspiration can be good. Aspiration itself, to achieve enlightenment for the sake of sentient beings. Second one here, she translates as belief. Jeffrey also translates as belief. You could also call it as appreciation. Appreciation or belief, having experienced an object, wants to keep it around. You've appreciated it, right? Mindfulness comes about because of appreciation or belief. Mindfulness is a mental factor that keeps you from forgetting the object. It even is present, can be present in the eye consciousness. It's not like the eye thinks, I want to keep that in mind. It's just because of mindfulness that you're able to focus on something without being distracted onto something else. Then as a result of mindfulness, you can develop samadhi. Do you know the word samadhi? Indian word?
Like nirvana.
No, it's not like nirvana. Who's Susan? Yeah, it means single point of concentration. In Tibetan... Yeah, you're thinking something else. So in Tibetan, it's called tingnezin, single point of concentration. An example of single point of concentration, fully qualified single point of concentration, would be shine or shamatha. But there's other kinds of samadhis. Even holding an object with the eye consciousness for certain number of moments in succession, that is samadhi. It doesn't mean, you know, if someone says, you know, I have samadhi, I've meditated a long time, you say, I have samadhi too. There's no big deal. Samadhi is present in whenever you know an object and you keep on it for some moments of time. But fully qualified samadhi is tranquil abiding. And then the fifth object ascertaining mental factor is wisdom, sharab, or prajna, like we talk about the prajna paramita. None of these are virtuous or non-virtuous by their own nature. Even wisdom. Wisdom can be used to do negative things, right? Make bombs and so forth. So I just want to, before I finish, even though I'm like a couple, 5 minutes over, I wanted to answer Shankar's question that he sent in an email. Not Shankar, Shankar. You know, Shankar's in India, and mommy passed away. He's there for her cremation and, you know, all of that sort of family stuff. But he listened to our last class, the MP3. That should give you some energy, Don Brown, to catch up. You know, Shankar in India listened to the MP3s of the classes. And he had a question when I talked about, last time I said, we were talking about compositional factors. The compositional factors aggregate, you know, the five aggregates? What are they? Form, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, consciousness, which means primary consciousness, not mental factors. Consciousness means these three, feeling, discrimination, are the two of the five omnipresent mental factors. And then I said the rest of the 49 mental factors are in this fourth aggregate, compositional factors. And he took that to mean, unless I misspoke at the time, he took that to mean that's all that was there. And he said, isn't karma, aren't there some other things like karma in the fourth compositional factor? So I wanted to address that for a second. First of all, is karma, what is karma?
Action.
Action. What did we learn right now? Karma is intention. Intention is the thing, the mental factor intention is what creates karma. Is intention in here? Yeah, intention is in compositional factors. So the karma that we create, any particular instance could be said to be a compositional factor. But there are other kinds of karma. Some the physical actions themselves, according to the Prasangika, the highest philosophical school, karma is of two types. Intention, the mental factor intention that moves the mind, and whether there are other factors, virtuous or non-virtuous in the mind, it creates the karma. That movement of the mind is one kind, but even the physical action of stabbing or, you know, giving medicine or giving alms or whatever could be virtuous or non-virtuous. Physical actions themselves, from the Prasangika and even the Vaivashika, the lowest philosophical school, can be virtuous or non-virtuous. So those actions wouldn't be in the compositional factors aggregate, would they? Where would they be? No, they would be in the form aggregate, interestingly enough. Subtle kind of form, the actions. So what about this? He asked whether non-associated compositional factors are part of the compositional factors aggregate. Do you know what non-associated compositional factors are? Compositional factors, generally, we say there are three kinds of impermanent phenomena. What? Matter, or form, physical things. Consciousness is a different continuum than matter. You can't create consciousness out of matter. It's of a different entity. And non-associated compositional factors, other impermanent things that are neither associated with mind nor material. What's an example of a non-associated compositional factor? Anyone know?
Like cow.
Cow. Well, explain what you mean. That could be right or could be wrong, depending on what you're thinking. Cow.
A
because cow as a label, as a concept, is not, it's neither consciousness or
form. It's not the form aggregate of the cow. How about, what's your name again, Michael?
Mark.
Mark. Yeah. So Mark, well, this is rather than cow, let's say Mark, the person. A person is a non-associated compositional factor. Mm-hmm. Does a person exist? It's a conventional truth, right?
Yeah.
Person exists. People exist. So the person Mark exists. Is the person Mark permanent?
No.
No, it's impermanent. So is the person Mark consciousness?
No.
Sometimes we might think that. Is the person Mark body? We might associate the body and say, oh, that's Mark. But Mark is a phenomena that we label. Person is a phenomena we label onto to the combination of the five aggregates. You know, we label Mark onto his five aggregates, or the body and the mind, if you abbreviate some of them into that. So person, would the person, would Mark's being a person or self, would that be found in his five aggregates?
No.
Yeah, why not? Isn't it impermanent? Isn't it part of your continuum? Isn't it the same entity as your aggregates, the person? It's not a separate entity from the aggregates,
is it? It's labeled upon the base.
Right. It's labeled on the basis of the aggregates. But if you talk about Mark's five aggregates, wouldn't the person, Mark, and his age, his duration, and other things that are impermanent, that are called compositional factors, non-associated compositional factors, wouldn't they be included in the compositional factors aggregate?
Yeah.
Who said no? Oh, you said yes. Okay. Even that. Who said yes? So, indeed, Mark, the person Mark, or person, is included in the compositional factor aggregate, but there's a differentiation to make. The five aggregates, which are the basis for designating Mark, imputing Mark, Mark is not included in the compositional factor aggregate of those five aggregates, because you'd be imputing Mark on Mark. It's a subtle point. Think about that. It'll get your mind really, you have to try to think of that. It's like looking at something from all different directions, new thinking. So there is a differentiation made sometime. Compositional factors, which the compositional factor person and the compositional factors other than the person. So the compositional factors in your continuum that other than the person Mark, they are the basis for imputing Mark. But indeed, the person Mark, or the self, our own self, is a compositional factor. A non-associated compositional factor. It's not mind, it's not body, it's not associated with either. Okay? What do you think? Okay, so I've gone over a little bit. I will end here and ask you if you would try to go over these five object ascertaining mental factors, which we'll go over next time, and read the next section after that. In this text, what's the next section after the object ascertaining? Does it go to the delusions, or does it go to the virtuous mental factors, or what?
Virtuous.
Goes to virtuous. So also read for next time the 11 virtuous mental factors. Okay? Try to get familiar with that, and we will continue next time. Now, I will hand over the class to Donna and Venerable, whoever is acting as the representative, and you guys can debate a little bit about these things, discuss and debate. Do you have any questions from your debate last time that you didn't get a suitable answer for?
Does.
Who does? Joey has a question?
I think it was kind of explained tonight, but we were talking about primary mind with the senses, and we were wondering if the feeling of pleasant and unpleasant, if the omnipresent mental factors were included in the senses. But I think you kind of covered
it. Yeah, omnipresent mental factor is definitely included in the senses. And whenever you have a sense consciousness that knows an object, has, you know, right, you know, is alert, there's also the five object ascertaining mental factors that will be present. So in general, in a consciousness that knows this object, like an eye that sees a yellow cup or something like that, that would have the five omnipresent mental factors and the five object ascertaining mental factors in its retinue. But it wouldn't have any of the other mental factors, would it? Wouldn't have the 11 virtuous and the eye consciousness. Eye consciousness is not, it's not virtuous or non-virtuous. It wouldn't have the delusions, the secondary delusions, or the changeable matter factors. I have a little doubt about that. Maybe the mental factor sleep, changeable mental factor, is present in the eye. You might not say your eye sleeps, but sleep is defined as a drawing in of the consciousness. Anyway, something to investigate. The other thing that was, I understood from some of your questions last time, is whether wasn't intention virtuous or non-virtuous. But remember I mentioned intention is like the hand with a cloth underneath it moving, moves the mind, and it depends on what it moves. If within the retinue of the mind there are mental factors that are virtuous, it creates virtuous karma. What about the intention in the eye consciousness? Since there are no virtuous or non-virtuous mental factors in the eye consciousness, that intention is just like the cloth just going over the tabletop without polish or grit underneath. It just creates neutral karma. Still creates karma, but it doesn't create virtuous or non-virtuous. It's the mental consciousness that, in that case, that would be motivating you to look in certain ways that creates a virtuous or non-virtuous karma.
Well, I have one more question now.
Oh, okay.
Since that you were talking about intention is usually accompanied by another mental factor, are you saying that two mental factors can arise at the same time, or?
Oh, yeah. Well, let's say the five omnipresent mental factors are all present at the same time. Right? So there's an example. And in a consciousness that knows its object, the five object ascertaining mental factors, aspiration, appreciation, and so forth, are also present. So they're at least 10. There's some exceptions. If you have a virtuous mental factor in the mind, there cannot coexist in that mind a non-virtuous mental factor. So you can't be both, angry and faithful or something at the same time. If you can keep your mind in a virtuous state, like, say, in faith, with faith in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, you know, then your mind can, there's no room for a negative factor to come. It may be some things on the outskirts of your mind, memories coming or a little devil talking to you or something. But when, an antidote to the delusions, when the antidote is present, that delusion can't be present because the antidote would be some kind of virtuous mind. Like, say, for instance, antidote to anger. One antidote to anger could be generating patience. That's able, the patience that thinks, I can bear this suffering, and rather than thinking, I can't bear this, I got to strike out. So having just that kind of patience present, which is a virtuous mental factor, anger can't be present at the same time. So you can't have a mind that has both virtuous and non-virtuous mental factors at the same time. But you can have, within the retinue, you can have the omnipresent mental factors, the object ascertaining mental factors, virtuous or non-virtuous mental factors, and even the changeable mental factors like analysis and investigation. When you're meditating, they could be present. You're investigating emptiness and then analyzing it in detail. Does that help?
There was one thing you had mentioned about the contact preceding feeling.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if the omnipresent...
Now, Don's going to get angry because you're getting more follow-ups than he got. Okay.
Is there a sequential order to the omnipresent?
Well, they're all going to be present, but when you talk about any one instant of mind, you know, one instant of feeling would have been preceded by a previous moment of contact. Contact had to be present to for that consciousness to arise and to know that it had to be constantly always there, that particular aspect that empowers the sense power, the faculty, the organ. Generally, as a result of feeling, we will have feeling is not the problem. It's our response to feeling that becomes our problem. For pleasant feelings, we often develop attachment. You know, that's nice. Oh, that's nice. A little to the left, you know, getting massage or something. Or if there's some irritation, unpleasant feeling, we develop a little bit of irritation that can turn into anger. So we have to guard the mind to recognize the feelings without, you know, to be content with desire for pleasant feelings or preference for pleasant feelings. But if you don't have the feelings, it's still okay. You know. But if you turn into attachment for pleasant feelings or resentment or anger toward unpleasant situations, you know, arising from unpleasant feeling, then that's problematic. So let me leave you to debate, discuss. Okay, thank you very much.